esclavos, de buena disposición, y muchos salieron bravos.
De su tierra de leones se olvidaron como niños, y aquí los aquerenciaron la costumbre y los cariños.
Rise and shine, everyone. It is Saturday morning, and I am so happy to see you or hear you or be here with you. I'm here in the station, and it is the first week of October, and it is just getting really beautiful up here in Vermont. So let me remind you where you are. You are listening to WGDR Plainfield, WGDH Hardwick, Central Vermont Community Radio, 91.1 FM and 91.7 FM if you're up in the Northeast Kingdom. And I have a special announcement for you folks today. Community support for Amy's Kids Show is provided in part by Woodbury Mountain Toys, featuring a selection of toys and games for kids of all ages. Located at 24 State Street in Montpelier, Vermont. More information about Woodbury Mountain Toys can be found at woodburymountaintoys.com. Come in and play with us is what they say at Woodbury Mountain Toys. And boy, come on in and play with us today. This is Amy's Kids Show, and we have a special show lined up today, a whole hour of fun and celebration. And we are reading chapter 9 from A Wrinkle in Time. We are almost to the end of the book. I know this is super exciting. The dogs are excited. The chickens are excited. Everybody's excited because it's the perfect morning for this kind of story. We're getting into October now. Right? It's October and the leaves are changing up here in Vermont, and it's starting to just get so beautiful and feels like fall. And so we're starting to get to a little bit of the spooky part of the book, right? It's the last few chapters, and Meg and her brother, Charles Wallace, and their friend Calvin are saving Mr. Murray, and they are about to do it right now. Meg, with all of her courage and all of her good qualities and her bad qualities, her faults and everything, are going to work together and help her rescue her father from the transparent column. And so today, we are reading Chapter 9, and its title is only two letters. Two letters. It's a two-letter chapter title. It's called It. And in the book here, It is, every time it is written in this book, It is spelled with two capital letters, I-T, I-T, in big capital letters. So It. Now, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to read it IT or read it as it. I've been reading it as it. So we're going to celebrate it today. The whole first half of the show, before we start our story, are all songs that have the word it in it. So there you go. Every time you hear the word it, maybe you should jump. Well, I don't know. Maybe you'll get tired if you do that. But anyway, have fun with it. And then we'll be back in a little while to read it. How does that sound, folks? I'm having fun already with this. All right, happy Saturday. Let's get started.
When your favorite toy has just broken apart and you're having a terrible day, there's a little old man that can bring back your smile. He'll patch up your treasure in just a short while. He's got spectacles down to the tip of his nose. He's a bit roly-poly and gray. Just pick up your pieces and don't be distraught. Go to Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. If toys need repair, you really must stop there. He'll make them like new, he'll make them tip-top at Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. His place is a mess, a mechanical zoo. How he finds things, well, I never could. There's rockets and ragdolls and wagons and planes, bicycles, buggies, and parts of old trains. He's a master with metal and plastic and glue, tools and machines to fix wood. He can put back together a toy that went flop. Go to Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. If toys need repair, you really must stop there. He'll make them like new, he'll make them tip top. At Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. Using gadgets and gizmos and jiggers and such, doohickeys, doo-whoppers, twizzles to touch. He'll mend it, restore it, and give it some fizz. No wonder kids love him and call him the Whiz. He can make something beep, he can make it go zoom, he can make something blast to the moon. A mechanical genius with motors and gears. He can lift up your spirits and dry up your tears. He can make something ring, he can make it go whoosh, he can give it a musical tune. So if toys need repair, well, you really must stop at Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. If toys need repair, you really must stop there. He'll make them like new, he'll make them tip top. At Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop. At Mr. McWiz Widgets Fix It Up Shop.
Unless you give it a try. What may seem impossible is easy as pie. Take a look around you, then jump in with both feet. A world of wonders waiting, so get off of your seat. Something new may seem scary to you. Different places are filled with all new faces. Take some time, discover all the signs. Soon you'll know just everywhere you go. You'll never know you can unless you give it a try. What may seem impossible is easy as pie. Take a look around you, then jump in with both feet. A world of wonders waiting, so get off of your seat. Hey, look around, you can charter new ground. Near or far, you can reach for a star. Set a date, there's no need to wait. Start right now, before long you'll say, wow! You'll never know you can unless you give it a try. What may seem impossible is easy as pie. Take a look around you, then jump in with both feet. A world of wonders waiting, so get off of your seat. Every day you can find a new way. Every chance you can learn a new dance. Life can be an opportunity. Take a turn, there's so much you can learn. Oh, you never know you can unless you give it a try. What may seem impossible is easy as pie. Take a look around you, then jump in with both feet. A world of wonders waiting, so get off of your seat. You'll never know unless you give it a try. Anything is possible, so give it a try.
Real big trouble. One, two, three. Real big trouble. trouble, yeah, but oh no. Think hard, what did I do? I didn't do it, I didn't do it. Do what? I didn't do it, I didn't do it. Do what? I didn't mean it. I didn't do it, do it, do it, do what? That little mess I made with my new chemistry set, it really wasn't my fault. Explosion got everything wet.
Cups and plates, who left the light on in their room? There's clothing hanging from the drawers, open books and dinosaurs. Come on, let's put it all away. Pick it up and put it away. Let's not wait for someone to say who left these trucks and comic books, dolls and pocketbooks, videos, DVDs and pets. Left their computer on. Where have all those cookies gone? Come on, let's put it all away. Pick it up, please put it away. Let's not wait for someone to say who left their bike and helmet by the door, jigsaw puzzles on the floor, joysticks, batteries and games, baseball mitts and basketball, whose underwear is in the hall. Come on, let's put it all away. Pick it up, please put it away. Let's not wait for someone to say whose pillows, blanket, sheets and towels, Barbie Ken and all their pals, mommy's dresses, daddy's suits, sneakers, slippers, hiking boots, silver jet and red caboose, cereal and orange juice. Pick it up and put it all away. I took a step and heard a crunch. There's that bag of chips from lunch. Pick it up and put it all away. Just once could I sit on the couch without the words, what's this? And ouch! Come on, let's put it all. Please don't argue, please don't stall. Pick it up and put it all away. Please pick it up and put it all away.
Shake it, shake it, shake it high, shake it, shake it, shake it low, shake it, shake it on your tongue, shake it, shake it on your toe. Shake it, shake it, shake it high, shake it, shake it, shake it low, shake it, shake it on your tongue, shake it, shake it on your toe. Shake it.
chicken, chicken high, shake it, chicken, chicken low, shake it, chicken on your top, shake it, chicken on your toe.
One, three, five, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, five, two, three, four, sharp, five. And the eight is the same as the one, but an octave apart. Try to learn it by heart.
One, three, five, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, five, two, three, four, sharp, five. And the eight is the same as the one, but an octave apart. Try to learn it by heart.
1, 3, 5, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 5, 2, 3, 4, sharp 5. And the 8 is the same as the 1, but an octave apart. Try to learn it by heart.
1, 3, 5, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 5, 2, 3, 4,
sharp 5. And the 8 is the same as the 1, but an octave apart. Try to learn it by heart.
And the 8 is the same as the 1, but an octave apart. Try to learn it by heart. And the 8 is the same as the 1, but an octave apart. Try to learn it by heart. And the 8 is the same as the 1, but an octave apart. Try to learn it by heart.
Folks, welcome back. Did you try to learn it by heart? Learn it by heart? Well, repeating things is a great way to memorize them, that's for sure. To learn it by heart. That's so that you can just say it again. Boy, I would love to learn that number song, that those musical notes, and memorize them. I would have to repeat them a number of times, though, probably. I'd have to hear the song a few more times to learn it. So that's a great way to learn. Another great way to learn and memorize and learn it by heart is to make pictures in our minds, you know, as we're learning something, and tie those pictures together in our brains. That's one of the tricks that people use to memorize things and learn it by heart. Well, it's going to turn out that learning things by heart is one of the skills that that Meg is going to use to save her father. This is very exciting. All right, so we are on to chapter 9 in A Wrinkle in Time. This is a book by Madeline L'Engle, and we've been reading it here on Amy's Kids Show for a number of weeks. We only have a couple of chapters left after this, so we are getting to the end of the story. It's getting very exciting, and this is a coming-of-age story, which means it's about the main character that it's about is a girl named Meg, and she's coming of age. That means she is, you know, she's a teenager. She's growing up. She is going to actually save her father right now, which is quite, you know, a mature thing to do. Quite a, like taking power in the world and owning your skills and using them to make a difference. That's what it's all about. That's what coming of age is about. And she's going to do something amazing here. And even her faults, the qualities about herself that she doesn't really like so much, that she thinks are problems, are actually going to help her. Just like Mrs. Witch told her. Or was it Mrs. What's-It? I forget which Mrs. told her that her faults were going to save her, but they surely are. So here we go. This is Chapter 9, It. And Charles Wallace, Meg, and Kelvin have just come upon the transparent column. And inside the transparent column is Meg's father, Mr. Murray. So they just found him. Chapter 9, It. Capital IT. Meg rushed at the man imprisoned in the column, but as she reached what seemed to be the open door, she was hurled back as though she had crashed into a brick wall. Kelvin caught her. "It's just transparent, like glass this time," he told her. "We can't go through it." Meg was so sick and dizzy from the impact that she could not answer. For a moment, she was afraid that she would throw up or faint. Charles Wallace, her little brother, laughed again. Remember, guys, that Charles Wallace has gone into it, and now it is sort of controlling him. It's not the real Charles Wallace. He's not being as nice as the real Charles Wallace. We'll get back to the story. Charles Wallace laughed again, the laugh that was not his own. And it was this that saved her, for once more, anger overcame her pain and her fear. Charles Wallace, Meg's own real, dear Charles Wallace, never laughed at her when she hurt herself. Instead, his arms would go quickly around her neck, and he would press his soft cheek against hers in loving comfort. But the demon Charles Wallace snickered. She turned away from him and looked again at the man in the column. "Oh, Father," she whispered longingly, but the man in the column did not move to look at her. The horn-rimmed glasses, which always seemed so much a part of him, were gone, and the expression of his eyes was turned inward, as though he were in a deep thought. He had grown a beard, and the silky brown was shot with gray. His hair, too, had not been cut. It wasn't just the overlong hair of the man in the snapshot picture at Cape Canaveral. It was pushed back from his high forehead and fell softly almost to his shoulders, so that he looked like someone in another century or a shipwrecked sailor. But there was no question, despite the change in him, that he was her father, her own beloved father. "My, he looks a mess, doesn't he?" Charles Wallace said and sniggered. Meg swung on him with sick rage. "Charles, that's Father, Father!" "So what?" Meg turned away from him and held out her arms to the man in the column. "He doesn't see us, Meg," Kelvin said gently. "Why? Why?" "I think it's sort of like those little peepholes they have in apartments, in the front doors," Kelvin explained. "You know, from inside you can look through and see everything, and from outside you can't see anything at all. We can see him, but he can't see us." "Charles," Meg pleaded, "let me in to Father." "Why?" Charles said placidly. Meg remembered that when they were in the room with the man with the red eyes, she had knocked Charles Wallace back to himself when she tackled him and his head cracked the floor. So she hurled herself at him, but before she could reach him, his fist shot out and punched her hard in the stomach. She gasped for breath. Sickly, she turned away from her brother, back to the transparent wall. There was the cell. There was the column with her father inside. Although she could see him, although she was almost close enough to touch him, he seemed further away than he had been when she had pointed him out to Kelvin in the picture on the piano. He stood there quietly, as though frozen in a column of ice, an expression of suffering and endurance on his face that pierced into her heart like an arrow. "You say you want to help Father?" Charles Wallace's voice came from behind her, with no emotion whatsoever. "Yes, don't you?" Meg demanded, swinging around and glaring at him. "But, of course, that is why we are here." "Then what do we do?" Meg tried to keep the franticness out of her voice, trying to sound as drained of feeling as Charles, but nevertheless ending on a squeak. "You must do as I have done and go into it," Charles said. "No," Meg replied. "I can see you don't really want to save Father." "How will my being a zombie save Father?" "You will just have to take my word for it, Margaret," came the cold, flat voice from Charles Wallace. "It wants you, and it will get you. Don't forget that I, too, am part of it now. You know I wouldn't have done it if it weren't the right thing to do." "Kelvin," Meg asked in agony, "will it really save Father?" But Kelvin was paying no attention to her. he seemed to be concentrating with all his power on Charles Wallace. He stared into the pale blue that was all that was left of Charles Wallace's eyes. "And for thou wast a spirit too delicate to act her earthy and abhorred commands, she did confine thee into a cloven pine," he whispered. And Meg recognized Mrs. Hu's words to him. For a moment, Charles Wallace seemed to listen. Then he shrugged and turned away. Kelvin followed him, trying to keep his eyes focused on Charles's. "If you want a witch, Charles," he said, "it's the witch, not our ladies. Good thing I had the tempest at school this year, isn't it, Charles? It was the witch who put Ariel in the cloven pine, wasn't it, Charles?" Charles Wallace's voice seemed to come from a great distance. "Stop staring at me." Breathing quickly with excitement, Kelvin continued to pin Charles Wallace with his stare. "You're like Ariel in the cloven pine, Charles, and I can let you out. Look at me, Charles. Come back to us." Again, the shudder went through Charles Wallace. Kelvin's intense voice hit at him. "Come back, Charles. Come back to us." Again, Charles shuddered. And then it was as though an invisible hand had smacked against his chest and knocked him to the ground, and the stare with which Kelvin had held him was broken. Charles sat there on the floor of the corridor whimpering. Not a small boy's sound, but a fearful animal noise. "Kelvin," Meg turned on him, clasping her hands intensely. "Try to get into father." Kelvin shook his head. "Charles almost came out. I almost did it. He almost came back to us." "Try father," Meg said again. "How? Your cloven pine thing. Isn't father imprisoned in a cloven pine even more than Charles? Look at him in that column there. Get him out, Kelvin." Kelvin spoke in an exhausted way. "Meg, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get in. Meg, they're asking too much of us." "Mrs. Who's spectacles," Meg said suddenly. Mrs. Who had told her to use them only as a last resort, and surely that was now. She reached into her pocket, and the spectacles were there, cool and light and comforting. With trembling fingers, she pulled them out. "Give me those spectacles," Charles Wallace's voice came in a harsh command, and he scrambled up off the floor and ran at her. She barely had time to snatch off her own glasses and put on Mrs. Who's, and, as it was, one earpiece dropped down her cheek, and they barely stayed on her nose. As Charles Wallace lunged at her, she flung herself against the transparent door, and she was through it. She was in the cell with the imprisoning column that held her father. With trembling fingers, she straightened Mrs. Who's glasses and put her own in her pocket for safekeeping. "Give them to me," came Charles Wallace's menacing voice, and he was in the cell with her, with Kelvin on the outside, pounding frantically to get in. Meg kicked at Charles Wallace and ran at the column. She felt as though she were going through something dark and cold, but she was through. "Father," she cried, and she was in his arms. This was the moment for which she had been waiting, not only since Mrs. Witch whisked them off on their journeys, but during the long months and years before, when the letters had stopped coming, when people made remarks about Charles Wallace, when Mrs. Murray showed a rare flash of loneliness or grief. This was the moment that meant that now and forever, everything would be all right. As she pressed against her father, all was forgotten except joy. There was only the peace and comfort of leaning against him, the wonder of the protecting circle of his arms, the feeling of complete reassurance and safety that his presence always gave her. Her voice broke on a happy sob. "Oh, father! Oh, father! Meg!" he cried in glad surprise. "Meg! What are you doing here? Where's your mother? Where are the boys?" She looked out of the column, and there was Charles Wallace in the cell, an alien expression distorting his face. She turned back to her father. There was no more time for greeting, for joy, for explanations. "We have to go to Charles Wallace," she said, her words tense. "Quickly." Her father's hands were moving gropingly over her face, and as she felt the touch of his strong, gentle fingers, she realized with a flooding of horror that she could see him, that she could see Charles in the cell and Calvin in the corridor, but her father could not see them, could not see her. She looked at him in panic, but his eyes were the same steady blue that she remembered. She moved her hand briskly across the line of his vision, but he did not blink. "Father," she cried, "Father, can't you see me?" His arms went around her again in a comforting, reassuring gesture. "No, Meg." "But Father, I can see you." Her voice trailed off. Suddenly, she shoved Mrs. Hu's glasses down her nose and peered over them, and immediately she was in complete and utter darkness. She snatched them off her face and thrust them at her father. "Here!" His fingers closed about the spectacles. "Darling," he said, "I'm afraid your glasses won't help." "But they're Mrs. Hu's. They aren't mine," she explained, not realizing that her words would sound like gibberish to him. "Please try them, Father, please." She waited while she felt him fumbling in the dark. "Can you see now?" she asked. "Can you see now, Father?" "Yes," he said, "yes. The wall is transparent now. How extraordinary. I could almost see the atoms rearranging." His voice had its old, familiar sound of excitement and discovery. It was the way he sounded sometimes when he came home from his laboratory after a good day and began to tell his wife about his work. Then he cried out, "Charles! Charles Wallace!" And then, "Meg, what's happened to him? What's wrong? That is Charles, isn't it?" "It has him, Father," she explained tensely. "He's gone into it. Father, we have to help him." For a long moment, Mr. Murray was silent. The silence was filled with the words he was thinking and would not speak out loud to his daughter. Then he said, "Meg, I'm in prison here. I've been for..." "Father, these walls, you can go through them. I came through the column to get into you. It was Mrs. Who's glasses that helped." Mr. Murray did not stop to ask who Mrs. Hu was. He slapped his hand against the transparent column. "It seems solid enough." "But I got in," Meg repeated. "I'm here. Maybe the glasses helped the atoms rearrange. Try it, Father." She waited, breathlessly, and after a moment she realized that she was alone in the column. She put out her hands in the darkness and felt its smooth surface curving about her on all sides. She seemed utterly alone, the silence and darkness impenetrable forever. She fought down panic until she heard her father's voice coming to her very faintly, "I'm coming back in for you, Meg." It was almost a tangible feeling as the atoms of the strange material seemed to part to let him in through her, to let him through to her. In their beach house at Cape Canaveral, there had been a long curtain between dining and living room made of long strands of rice. It looked like a solid curtain, but you could walk right through it. At first, Meg had flinched each time she came up to the curtain, but gradually she got used to it and would go running right through, leaving the long strands of rice swinging behind her. Perhaps the atoms of these walls were arranged in somewhat the same fashion. "Put your arms around my neck, Meg," Mr. Murray said. "Hold on to me tightly. Close your eyes and don't be afraid." He picked her up and she wrapped her long legs around his waist and clung to his neck. With Mrs. Hu's spectacles on, she had felt only a faint darkness and coldness as she moved through the column. Without the glasses, she felt the same awful clamminess she had felt when they tessered through the outer darkness of Kamazots. Whatever the black thing was to Kamazots, that the Kamazots had submitted to. It was within as well as without the planet. For a moment it seemed that the chill darkness would tear her from her father's arms. She tried to scream, but within that icy horror, no sound was possible. Her father's arms tightened about her, and she clung to his neck in a stranglehold, but she was no longer lost in panic. She knew that if her father could not get her through the wall, he would stay with her rather than leave her. She knew that she was safe as long as she was in his arms. Then they were outside. The column rose up in the middle of the room, crystal clear and empty. Meg blinked at the blurred figures of Charles and her father and wondered why they did not clear. Then she grabbed her own glasses out of her pocket and put them on, and her myopic eyes were able to focus. Charles Wallace was tapping one foot impatiently against the floor. "It is not pleased," he said. "It is not pleased at all." Mr. Murray released Meg and knelt in front of the little boy. "Charles," he said. His voice was tender. "Charles Wallace." "What do you want?" "I'm your father, Charles. Look at me." The pale blue eyes seemed to focus on Mr. Murray's face. "Hi, Pop," came an insolent voice. "That isn't Charles," Meg cried. "Oh, Father, Charles isn't like that. It has him." "Yes," Mr. Murray sounded tired. "I see." He held his arms out. "Charles, Charles, come here." Father will make it all right, Meg thought. Everything will be all right now. Charles did not move toward the outstretched arms. He stood a few feet away from his father and did not look at him. "Look at me," Mr. Murray commanded. "No." Mr. Murray's voice became harsh. "When you speak to me, you will say no, Father, or no, sir." "Come off it, Pop," came the cold voice from Charles Wallace. Charles Wallace, who, outside Kamazots, had been strange, had been different, but never rude. "You are not the boss around here." Meg could see Calvin pounding again on the glass wall. "Calvin," she called. "He can't hear you," Charles said. He made a horrible face at Calvin, and then he thumbed his nose.
"Who's Calvin?" Mr. Murray asked.
"He's..." Meg started, but Charles Wallace cut her short. "You'll have to defer your explanations. Let's go."
"Go where?"
"To it."
"No,"
Mr. Murray said. "You can't take Meg there."
"Oh, I can't, huh?"
"No, you cannot. You're my son, Charles, and I'm afraid you will have to do as I say."
"But he isn't Charles," Meg said in anguish. Why didn't her father understand? "Charles is nothing like that, Father. You know he's nothing like that."
"He was only a baby when I left," Mr. Murray said heavily.
"Father, it's it talking through Charles. It isn't Charles. He's bewitched."
"Fairy tales again," Charles said.
"You know it, Father?" Meg asked.
"Yes."
"Have you seen it?"
"Yes, Meg." Again, his voice sounded exhausted. "Yes, I have." He turned to Charles. "You know, she wouldn't be able to hold out."
"Exactly," Charles said.
"Father, you can't talk to him as though he were Charles. Ask Calvin. Calvin will tell you."
"Come along," Charles Wallace said. "We must go."
He held up his hand carelessly and walked out of the cell, and there was nothing for Meg and Mr. Murray to do but to follow. As they stepped into the corridor, Meg caught at her father's sleeve.
"Calvin, Calvin, here's Father."
Calvin turned anxiously toward them. His freckles and his hair stood out brilliantly against his white face.
"Make your introductions later," Charles Wallace said. "It does not like to be kept waiting."
He walked down the corridor, his gait seeming to get more jerky with each step. The others followed, walking rapidly to keep up.
"Does your father know about the Mrs. W's?" Calvin asked.
"There hasn't been any time for anything. Everything's awful." Despair settled like a stone in the pit of Meg's stomach.
She had been so certain that the moment she found her father, everything would be all right. Everything would be settled. All the problems would be taken out of her hands. She would no longer be responsible for anything. And instead of this happy and expected outcome, they seemed to be encountering all kinds of new troubles. "He doesn't understand about Charles," she whispered to Kelvin, looking unhappily at her father's back as he walked behind the little boy. "Where are we going?" Kelvin asked. "To it, Kelvin, and I don't want to go. I can't." She stopped, but Charles Wallace continued his jerky pace. "We can't leave Charles," Kelvin said. "They wouldn't like it." "Who wouldn't?" "Mrs. What's-It and Company." "But they've betrayed us, Kelvin. They brought us here to this terrible place, and they abandoned us." Kelvin looked at her in surprise. "You sit down and give up if you like," he said. "I'm sticking with Charles." He ran to keep up with Charles Wallace and Mr. Murray. "I didn't mean—" Meg started and pounded after them. Just as she caught up with them, Charles Wallace stopped and raised his hand. And there was the elevator again, its yellow light sinister. Meg felt her stomach jerk as the swift descent began. They were silent until the motion stopped, silent as they followed Charles Wallace through the long corridors and out into the street. The central intelligence building loomed up, stark and angular, behind them. "Do something," Meg implored her father silently. "Do something. Help. Save us." They turned a corner, and at the end of the street was a strange, dome-like building. Its walls glowed with a flicker of violet flame. Its silvery roof pulsed with ominous light. The light was neither warm nor cold, but it seemed to reach out and touch them. This, Meg was sure, must be where it was waiting for them. They moved down the street, more slowly now, and as they came closer to the domed building, the violet flickering seemed to reach out, to envelop them, to suck them in. They were inside. Meg could feel a rhythmical pulsing. It was a pulsing not only about her, but in her as well, as though the rhythm of her heart and lungs was no longer her own, but was being worked by some outside force. The closest she had come to the feeling before was when she had been practicing artificial respiration with Girl Scouts, and the leader, an immensely powerful woman, had been working on Meg, intoning, "Out goes the bad air, in comes the good," while her heavy hands pressed, released. Meg gasped, trying to breathe at her own normal rate, but the inexorable beat within and without her continued. For a moment, she could neither move nor look around to see what was happening to the others. She simply had to stand there, trying to balance herself into the artificial rhythm of her heart and lungs. Her eyes seemed to swim in a sea of red. Then things began to clear, and she could breathe without gasping like a beached fish, and she could look about the great circular domed building. It was completely empty except for the pulse, which seemed a tangible thing, and a round dais exactly in the center. Only on the dais lay what? Meg could not tell, and yet she knew that it was from this that the rhythm came. She stepped forward tentatively. She felt that she was beyond fear now. Charles Wallace was no longer Charles Wallace. Her father had been found, but he had not made everything all right. Instead, everything was worse than ever. And her adored father was bearded and thin and white and not omnipotent after all. No matter what happened next, things could be no more terrible or frightening than they already were. Oh, couldn't they? As she continued to step slowly forward, at last she realized that the thing on the dais she realized what the thing on the dais was. It was a brain. A disembodied brain. An oversized brain. Just enough larger than normal to be completely revolting and terrifying. A living brain. A brain that pulsed and quivered, that seized and commanded. No wonder the brain was called it. It was the most horrible, the most repellent thing she had ever seen, far more nauseating than anything she had ever imagined with her conscious mind or that had ever tormented her in her most terrible nightmares. But as she had felt she was beyond fear, so now she was beyond screaming. She looked at Charles Wallace, and he stood there, turned towards it, his jaw hanging slightly loose, and his vacant eyes slowly twirled. Oh yes, things could always be worse. These twirling eyes within Charles Wallace's soft, round face made Meg icy cold inside and out. She looked away from Charles Wallace and at her father. Her father stood there with Mrs. Hu's glasses still perched on his nose. Did he remember that he even had them on? And he shouted to Kelvin, "Don't give in!" "I won't! Help Meg!" Kelvin yelled back. It was absolutely silent within the dome, and yet Meg realized that the only way to speak was to shout with all the power possible. For everywhere she looked, everywhere she turned, was the rhythm, and it continued to control the systole and diastole of her heart, the intake and outlet of her breath. The red miasma began to creep before her eyes again, and she was afraid that she was going to lose consciousness, and if she did that, she would be completely in the power of it. Mrs. Watsit had said, "Meg, I give you your faults." What were her greatest faults? Anger, impatience, stubbornness? Yes. It was her faults that she turned to save herself now. With an immense effort, she tried to breathe against the rhythm of it. But its power was too strong. Each time she managed to take a breath out of rhythm, an iron hand seemed to squeeze her heart and lungs. Then she remembered that when they had been standing before the man with the red eyes, and the man with the red eyes had been intoning the multiplication table at them, Charles Wallace had fought against his power by shouting out nursery rhymes, and Kelvin by the Gettysburg Address. "Georgie Porgie, pudding pie," she yelled, "kissed the girls and made them cry." That was no good. It was too easy for nursery rhymes to fall into the rhythm of it. She didn't know the Gettysburg Address. How did the Declaration of Independence begin? She had memorized it only that winter, not because she was required to at school, but simply because she liked it. "We hold these truths to be self-evident," she shouted, "that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." As she cried out the words, she felt a mind moving in on her own, felt it seizing, squeezing her brain. Then she realized that Charles Wallace was speaking or being spoken through by it. "But that's exactly what we have on Kamazats. Kamazats is complete equality. Everybody exactly alike." For a moment, her brain reeled with confusion. Then came a moment of blazing truth. "No," she cried triumphantly. "Like and equal are not the same thing at all." "Good girl, Meg," her father shouted at her. But Charles Wallace continued as though there had been no interruption. "On Kamazats, all are equal. On Kamazats, everybody is the same as everybody else." But he gave her no argument, provided no answer, and she held on to her moment of revelation. Like and equal are two entirely different things. For the moment, she had escaped from the power of it. But how? She knew that her own puny little brain was no match for this great, bodiless, pulsing, writhing mass on the round dais. She shuddered as she looked at it. In the lab at school, there was a human brain preserved in formaldehyde, and the seniors preparing for college had to take it out and look at it and study it. Meg had felt that when the day came, she would never be able to endure it. But now she thought that if only she had a dissecting knife, she would slash at it, cutting ruthlessly through cerebellum. Words spoke within her directly this time, not through Charles. "Don't you realize that if you destroy me, you also destroy your little brother?" If that great brain were cut, were crushed, would every mind under its control on Kamazots die too? Charles Wallace and the man with the red eyes and the man who ran the number one spelling machine on the second grade level and all the children playing ball and skipping rope and all the mothers and the men and the women going in and out of the buildings. Was their life completely dependent on it? Were they all beyond the possibility of salvation? She felt the brain reaching at her again, and she felt her own stubbornness finally slip. Red fog glazed her eyes. Faintly, she heard her father's voice, though she knew he was shouting at the top of his lungs, "The periodic table of elements, Meg! Say it!" A picture flashed into her mind of winter evenings spent sitting before the open fire and studying with her father. "Hydrogen, helium," she started obediently. "Keep them in their proper atomic order. What next?" She knew it. "Yes, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine." She shouted the words at her father, turned away from it. "Neon, sodium, magnesium, aluminum, silicon, phosphorus." "Too rhythmical," her father shouted. "What's the square root of 5? For a moment, she was able to concentrate. "Rack your brains yourself, Meg. Don't let it rack them." "The square root of 5 is 2.236, she cried triumphantly, "because 2.236 times 2.236 equals 5. "What's the square root of 7? "The square root of 7 is..." She broke off. She wasn't holding out. It was getting at her, and she couldn't concentrate, not even on math, and soon she, too, would be absorbed in it. She would be an it. "Tesser, sir," she heard Calvin's voice through the red darkness. "Tesser." She felt her father grab her by the wrist. There was a terrible jerk that seemed to break every bone in her body, and then the dark nothing of tessering. If tessering with Mrs. What's-It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Which had been a strange and fearful experience, it was nothing like tessering with her father. After all, Mrs. Which was experienced at it, and Mr. Murray, how did he know anything about it at all? Meg felt that she was being torn apart by a whirlwind. She was lost in an agony of pain that finally dissolved into the darkness of complete unconsciousness. Wow, guys, that is the dramatic ending of chapter 9. Whew, boy, we definitely got to know it a little better. And now we're going to celebrate another, well, the most super powerful two-letter word in the entire universe. No. And I don't know if you heard the word no said a number of times in this chapter, but it was, and it was very important. So let's celebrate no, guys.
No is always no. If they say no, it means 1,000 times no. No plus no equals no. All no's lead to no, no, no. Shape of the letter O. Pardon me.
No.
Excuse me.
No.
May I stay? Can I go?
No.
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 stay, roll over.
No, no, no.
Finger pointing, eyebrows low, mouth in the shape of the letter O. Red beans, stop.
Folks, thank you for joining me for Amy's Kids Show. We are at the end of the show once again. We had a great time. We are still reading A Wrinkle in Time. We only have two chapters left now, guys. We are down to the climactic ending. Meg has saved her father. How exciting was that? And using that all-powerful word, no, did you hear that her father used it? She used it. Everybody used it. And that is the most powerful two-letter word in the universe. It's actually way more powerful than it. but there are other powerful two-letter words that have come up in this story and come up in life all the time. And I was just thinking about those, you know, two-letter words. That there aren't very many two-letter words in the world, are there? Especially words that aren't just connector words like of, you know, or on, but actual words that represent something, you know, real and tangible. And so I was thinking about the most powerful two-letter words I could think of besides no. Are we and us, right? We, W-E, and us, U-S. That's us, guys. And so those are the two other words that can help beat it. if we stay together and we stick together and we take care of us and each other, right? Which is what Meg and Calvin and Charles Wallace, the real Charles Wallace, are really doing in this story. So thank you for joining me on Amy's Kids Show. We will continue with that next week. And I still have a bunch of no songs that I ran out of time to play. So I will play some of those next week because they're really fun. And I love that word no. Why don't you practice that? That would be a good thing to practice this week. Practice no any chance you get, right? N-O, no. That's the two-letter word that that usually children learn when they're around 2 years old. You know any two-year-olds, right? Sometimes the reason why people get that, you know, say that terrible twos. They say two-year-olds can be a little challenging, you know, to take care of because they know the power of no, don't they? And they're using it and they're practicing it, and that can be a lot of fun for them and for everyone else if we can keep our sense of humor. So we're going to keep our sense of humor. We're going to do some memorizing. We're going to do some playing. We're going to go out there today and see what the beautiful leaves look like and enjoy the fall. Happy fall, everybody. Happy Saturday. Thanks for joining me on Amy's Kids Show. Have a great week.
You'll never know you can unless you give it a try. What may seem impossible is easy as pie. Take a look around you, then jump in with both feet. A world of wonders waiting, so get off of your seat. Something new may seem scary to you. Different places are filled with all new faces. Take some time, discover all the signs. Soon you'll know just everywhere you go. You'll never know you can unless you give it a try. What may seem impossible is easy as pie. Take a look around you, then jump in with both feet. A world of wonders waiting, so get off of your seat. Hey, look around, you can charter new ground. Near or far, you can reach for a star. Set a date, there's no need to wait. Start right now. Before long, you'll say.